Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. I'm a reporter here at WNYC, and I'm filling in for Brian again today. Getting parole is nearly impossible for prisoners who committed serious crimes at a young age. That's the finding of a new report by the American Civil Liberties Union. It looked at thousands of prisoners across the country who committed serious crimes as minors and youth, and found that parole boards rarely release prisoners after they've served their sentence, even when prisoners have participated in rehabilitation programs for years and do well at their jobs and earn degrees while they're in prison. The New York Times has also been documenting racial disparities in adults who get parole here in New York State, and they've actually posted some of the transcripts from parole hearings. If you haven't checked them out, you guys should. So joining me now to talk about the issue of parole, both among young offenders nationally and among adults here in New York State, is Issa Kohler-Hausman. She is an associate professor of law and sociology at Yale University, and she has represented clients who are seeking parole. Also in the studio is Sarah Mehta, human rights researcher at the American Civil Liberties Union and author of the new report, False Hope: How Parole Systems Fail Youth Serving Extreme Sentences. Issa and Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you both for joining us, and welcome to The Brian Lehrer Show. Sarah, I want to start with you. Your report found that parole boards give more weight to the crime that young people committed than everything else that they do to rehabilitate themselves. They basically just disregard everything else that they've done while they're in prison.
Right. Yeah, I think one of the problems both in New York but really around the country is that parole boards have way too many cases to really provide an individualized review that is necessary both for the public but certainly for the individuals facing parole. In New York alone, parole boards consider around 1,000 cases a month. If they saw a person for each business day of the month, that's talking about 50 to 100 hearings a day. So the actual hearing is probably only going to take 5 minutes. Often the commissioners don't even get to see the parole file until the day before. And for people who've served decades in prison, you know, those are hundreds or thousands of pages. So it's likely that the only thing they're actually going to see is the charge and the crime for which the person is convicted, and not the decades of good conduct, of support, of reentry plans, and all the other things that parole is really supposed to be looking at.
And Issa, who makes up parole boards? Like, how do parole board members get selected?
Here in New York State, the board members are appointed by the governor, and they are confirmed by the Senate. It's an open secret that parole board members are essentially positions of political patronage. And as the New York Times, the writing recently revealed, a lot of these people are people that have donated extensively to either local Democratic or Republican parties, or sometimes it's just a favor. Someone in a family or someone close associate needs a position. These are very secure positions. They're six-year appointments, $100,000 or more of salary. It's pretty good money, nice work if you can get it. And, of course, as Sarah pointed out, there's unfortunately, even when the law cabins and controls the discretion of the board, there just doesn't seem to be any political incentive, as far as these people feel, to do anything other than just hold people in. Unless, of course, the governor or governors want to try to make that clear that they want them to do something differently.
And Sarah, you said that some of their cases could be either hearing 100 cases a day of people who are asking to get out of prison. Tell us a little bit more about what the process is like. Like, what is the interaction between them? How fast are they making these decisions? I looked at some of the New York Times transcript, and it seems like these are very short conversations for pretty important decisions.
Right. No, you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, what's interesting compared to some other states like Texas and Georgia and North Carolina, states where there's no hearing, there's no interview, there's no interaction often between the parole board and the individual, New York on paper looks better because there is a hearing. Now, increasingly, it's not in person and it's on video conference. But there is an opportunity for the individual to be heard and to get a written decision. But as you've seen, these are happening in 5 minutes, and they're often incredibly hostile hearings for individuals. There are great organizations now in New York work like the Osborne Association and Fortune Society that are working with prisoners to try to prepare them. But very few people have lawyers. You know, Alyssa is really an exception. You know, there are very few opportunities for people to have assistance in preparing for the parole review. Now, people like Issa and other attorneys don't get to be in the actual hearing. But for a lot of prisoners, they spent decades in prison being told, don't talk about your crime, not always getting an opportunity to prepare. Prisoners told me that they didn't even know they were being reviewed until someone slipped a note under the door and said, your hearing is tomorrow. So they had no real opportunity to prepare themselves for what is often a very devastating and difficult and incredibly short interview where they don't get the chance to talk about, again, what parole is really supposed to be looking at. It's supposed to be forward looking.
And do the prisoners know, like, what the criteria the parole board has so that they can work towards that before their parole hearing?
That's a great question. I'll let Issa talk about that too. But, you know, one of the problems both in New York and around the country is there's just no transparency in terms of what individuals are supposed to be doing and what the parole board is actually looking at. Often they have no idea what the guidance or the factors are. But ultimately, there's so much discretion in the hands of parole board members that it may be that those factors and guidelines don't really matter very much. And certainly, you know, again, in New York, there is a written decision. There is some explanation given to the prisoners as to why they were denied. But often it's just boilerplate language, just cut and paste, usually the nature of the crime and nothing else, and certainly no recommendations and guidance as to what they need to be doing to improve and to get a real shot at release.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Sure. I just would add that, you know, to add the New York angle, here in New York State in 2011, the legislature actually significantly overhauled the executive law, which is the law that governs the decision-making and powers of the Board of Parole, to require it to use what it calls risk and needs principles, which are essentially, as Sarah said, these forward-looking principles. And usually that means these tools, like compass tools, or one of these risk and needs tools that you've heard probably a lot about when it comes to bail setting, right? And so the requirement in the law is that the board actually uses forward-looking risk and needs principles to evaluate suitability for release. However, this is just a perfect example of the multifaceted nature of parole and why it's so hard to reform it. Courts have essentially abdicated their constitutional responsibility to police the activity of the board. So even in cases where the risk and needs tool that the state has spent all this money adopting and all this time validating shows that the person is no risk of future violence, that this person is rehabilitated, they've done extensive programming, the board says, well, we've considered it. However, we find more compelling the crime of conviction, which is nothing more than a resentencing. And that's not the job's board under – that's not the board's job under the law. And very few courts have been willing to actually do their job and say to the board, this is irrational, this is wrong, and you have to go back and do it again. And this time – It's there's no other conclusion than this person is suitable for release.
These are people who got a sentence. Let's say their sentence was 30 years. They served their 30-year sentence, and then they're up for parole. And then parole says – the board says, actually, you're not ready for parole. And
exactly.
They have to wait. Right.
And it's the most tragic for juveniles, as we've shown, because these are people who have spent their entire adult life in prison and have done everything in their power to become a different person, to take responsibility. And the board just refuses to see that change. And in this case, it's a violation of the Constitution. It's a violation of the Eighth Amendment.
And listeners, join in on the conversation. Do you have an experience with the parole system? Give us a call. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or maybe you have a question for one of our guests today. Sarah, when you found that prisoners who have been denied prisoners have been denied parole as many as 17 times, and that they've had to wait before for their next parole hearing anywhere from 1 year to 24 years?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in New York, there is at least some requirement that people are seen every 2 years or within 2 years, which again is
still
a really
years.
Long time. It's certainly not a negligible period. And for those individuals, you know, when they're going up for parole, they have to prepare housing, they have to provide a job, they have to come up with a real plan for release. None of those things can stay for 2 years. They evaporate in that time. But it is true compared to other states in Texas, Tennessee, Oregon, Ohio, people can wait up to 10 years before being reviewed again. And in some states like Ohio and Utah, there is no statutory limit. So essentially, the parole board can turn a life with parole sentence into a life without parole sentence without ever having to even see the individual or review them again.
And can you give us some of the findings of your report? Like, how likely is are violent offenders who committed their crimes as minors, as juveniles, to get parole approved?
It really depends on the state, and unfortunately a lot of states don't make that data public. But in Maryland, for example, it's been 20 years since a juvenile lifer was released on parole. In states like Florida, the grant rate for juvenile lifers is 0.5%. In other states, it's slightly higher, up to maybe 8% or 11% in some states where people are serving life sentences. And again, I think what's important here is, and particularly in New York, almost 20% of the prison population in New York is serving a life sentence, right? So this is where the parole board has the most authority. They're the ones who are really deciding if you're going to live and die in prison. And, you know, as Issa was pointing out, our understanding of the constitutional requirements now is not just that you get out to die outside prison walls, but that there's a meaningful opportunity for release so that people can live and have a second chance in their productive years. New York has 632 individuals serving life sentences who were between the ages of 13 and 17 at the time of their offense. And, you know, almost 2,000 more who were 18 to 21. So these are people who are really young when they go to prison, are facing life and death in prison, and with vanishing opportunities of release.
Well, I know that the Supreme Court has recently ruled that minors cannot get life sentences without the possibility of parole, right? That they need hope for some years of life outside of prison walls. But I did a couple of stories on minors in adult prisons in New Jersey and looked at all of the people who are in adult prisons in New Jersey today for crimes that they committed as minors. And aside from finding that almost 90% of the minors who were tried as adults were Black or Latino, I also looked at their sentences. And I remember one inmate who was 16 when he committed two murders, and he was convicted of two murders, and he won't get the chance to go before a parole board until the year 2116, which is 100 years from now. Besides this one case, there was plenty of minors who were serving 30 years and 50 years and 60-year life sentences. And when I spoke to them, you know, in prison, they basically said that they didn't really think that they would actually be let out on parole, because I guess there's a perception that it doesn't really happen that often, which you have now proven.
Yeah, that's why the report is called False Hope, is that people are waiting. And that's the thing I think a lot of people don't understand, is that some of these individuals who get life sentences still have to serve 30, 35, 40 years before they're even first eligible for parole. Those are sentences that are much longer than adults get in most Western European countries. And that's just before you first get an opportunity to get a review before the parole board. And unfortunately, you know, what has happened with the Supreme Court, which is so wonderful, there's been so much attention in recent years to limiting life without parole for juveniles, not completely. But despite that, a lot of the responsibility for deciding who's going to get out and when has been delegated to parole boards without serious attention to how they function.
Okay, I want to go to a caller, James in Elmont, or James Elmont. You're on WNYC.
Hello, how are you doing? I'm just chiming in. I did time about 25 years ago in New York State. I went to the parole board, and I was hit. And I fulfilled all the necessary requirements of parole, and I was hit to a CR. I had a pretty small sentence of a 2 to 4, and I wound up doing 32 months. And I'd like to say that also, when someone's released from prison, it's not over. You know, there are a lot of chances to regain your life and, you know, be a productive citizen. So, I mean, I don't really have any comments or any questions. I'm just chiming in to see if anyone needed any information from someone who actually did time and saw the parole board.
James, what was your parole hearing like? Do you remember?
Oh, wow. It was very fast. Those people are very disconnected from what's going on in the New York City Five Boroughs area. They're way upstate, and they really don't want to look you in the eye. They're shuffling papers for about 2 to 5 minutes, and they don't give you any answer, and you find out later that you have been hit with more time, and most people do get hit with more time.
And do you remember what did that feel like for you when you were standing there trying to make the case for why you should be released?
Well, they didn't even give me a chance to make the case. They asked me a few questions I asked briefly, and it seems like they had their mind made up before I walked in the door.
Okay. Thank you so much for your call, James.
I'd like to comment on James's, it's just heart-wrenching to hear that, because this is a man or woman's moment to try, as you said, Sarah, to make their case for freedom. And it's literally true in many of these cases that the outcome is predetermined. So in cases we've foiled Freedom of Information Law requested documents for parole hearings, and sometimes you can find something called a commissioner's worksheet, which is something that the commissioner literally writes the decision out before the hearing even starts. And again, as Sarah said, these people are getting, you know, somewhere between 20 to 25 packets of hundreds and thousands of pages of material. And it's just, I mean, it's just obvious they're not reviewing those materials. And it's relevant they pre-write those decisions because courts have found that even if the parole board doesn't consider all the statutory factors in the decision, if it was discussed, right, merely mentioned in the hearing, that somehow indicates that they're actually doing their job and considering other things. And the hearing is often just a cover for a predetermined outcome. And it's the most tragic, again, when you have young people who the more time they spend in prison, right, after 15 years, after 20 years, it becomes harder and harder for them to re-enter and actually be a productive member of society. So there's nothing that can be more unjust in this experience of thinking that you have a real shot. And that's why the title of Sarah's report is so moving. But it's not a real shot.
I want to go to Bob in Plainfield, New Jersey. Bob, welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Hi, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, I have a question and a comment. First of all, since the parole boards are made up of, like your guest just mentioned, of basically political appointees, would you happen to know what the racial makeup of most parole boards are? Like, are they predominantly white? Or are they diverse? What is the racial makeup of most parole boards? Do you know?
I don't know for most, but I will say in New York, it's markedly undiverse. it's almost all upstate people. I
don't. There's one person of color.
I think there's Tina Safford, the chairwoman. I do not think there is a single person right now on the board from the five borough area. Which is absolutely insane. And I want to point something out to the listeners.
Wait, there's not a single parole board member in New York City who is...
From New York City.
Oh, from New York City.
I don't think so. I actually do not think so. And the other thing that I would say that the listeners should know, if this is making you upset, I hope so, contact your state senators. Five or four of what I would say the most, the worst parole board members, the parole board members that just do not think that the law applies to them, that take no note of rehabilitation and reform, these people are up. Ludlow, William Smith, Elovich Ferguson, these are Pataki appointees that Cuomo in the past has for some reason reappointed, and the governor has the choice to reappoint them this in 2017, and the Senate will vote on it. So contact your state senators, contact the governor, and say that you're not going to let backroom Albany politics dealing be done on the back of the most vulnerable.
And speaking of racial diversity, the New York Times investigation into parole has found that among male adult prisoners under the age of 25 who had no prior state prison sentences, the parole board released 30% of white prisoners, but only 14% of black and Latino prisoners. Sarah, I know you didn't really look at the racial discrepancies in your report, but do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, we requested data that we did not get from New York State on the racial disparities in the grant rate. But one thing that was very clear to us and has already been mentioned is, again, the racial disparities at the front end for people serving life sentences are so striking. You know, I'm very curious as to what the grant rate would be for the life sentences, given that there are overwhelmingly people of color serving those sentences. I mean, among the 13 to 15-year-olds who got life sentences in New York, 70% are black and 18% are Latino. And those disparities continue as people get older as well. So I I'm not surprised that there are disparities in every part of that system.
Okay, let's go to another caller. Gene in Ulster County, New York, is a veteran of the Department of Corrections. Gene, welcome to WNYC. Gene, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I retired as a deputy superintendent of programs, and I spent 33 years in the department. one of my responsibilities was to, I don't want to say wine and dine the parole board, but, you know, to greet them when they came to the facility, back in the days when they came to the facility.
Interesting.
To ensure that, you know, they were comfortable and needs were met. And I remember one specific incident 13 years ago when a parole commissioner treated me like I was dirt, okay? I was a deputy superintendent. Wow. So can you imagine how an inmate felt if she made me, a colleague and a responsible department employee, feel terrible? Mm-hmm. I had a lot of experience with inmates before they went to the board, after they went to the board. I had experience with inmates who committed suicide 4 or 5 days after they got their board results. Horrible, horrible system. It truly is.
Oh, my gosh. Jean, thank you so much for calling in. I'm curious, when you spoke to people, did you speak to prisoners after their parole hearings about what it was like for them?
Oh, of course I did. Of course I did. I mean, you know, people would say, oh, you work up front. You're not with the inmates. Oh, no, I worked with the inmates. Mm-hmm. And, you know, guys would be devastated. You know, we would put suicide watches on people, informal suicide watches. I mean, in the department, there's a way, there's a formal suicide watch. But we, in my last facility, which was long-termers, many guys had done 30 years, 35 years. They'd seen the board 13, 14 times. We would have everybody in the facility watching these people to make sure that nobody was acting out of sorts or nobody seemed to be too depressed. How can you be too depressed when the board has hit you 12 times?
And, Jean, do you know, like, why the board members would deny these requests, parole 13 and 14 times?
In many cases, it was people who had life on the end sentence, and they would always cite, as your guest said earlier, the nature of the crime. You know, what a guy does at 18 is very different from what a person's going to do when he's 50. And when you see people who've done all the right things, they've gotten an education, they've gotten a vocational trade, they've completed substance abuse, they've taken college classes, they've obtained college degrees, they can be productive members of society and really should be given a chance.
All right. Jean, thank you so much for your call. And Issa, I think you wanted to comment on the suicide watch.
I did. I mean, I don't know if I'm sure if people have heard this, but there was recently just a tragic case of a man named John McKenzie who had served, I don't know, I guess I want to say
40 years.
Was it almost, I was going to say 39, 40 years on a, maybe it was 25 to life sentence. And he killed himself after, it was just a couple of months ago, after, I don't even know, 12 denials, 13 denials. And this is a man who had an amazing legal team working behind him. He had a court hold the board in contempt for its actions. So he was sort of winning, but every time they sent it back, the board just did it again. And this is what I'm saying. It is a lawless body. It is a lawless body. And until the governor and the courts really do their job, this is going to continue to happen. And in his case, the story is tragic, is that the PBA, the police officer union essentially had these massive robo letters of opposition and this incredible behind the scenes power. We don't get to see opposition. Victim opposition by statute is confidential, but they've taken this expansive reading of it. So quote unquote community opposition, which are essentially union letters against the release, are treated as dispositive. And that's, again, that's just a violation of the law. There's nothing in the law that gives them power to release on that.
Sarah, is there a state that is doing this better than the rest of the states or than New York City?
You know, there are states that have more safeguards. And, you know, what has been encouraging since the Supreme Court's decisions is a lot of states have taken it upon themselves to look at their parole boards and start to put in better procedures, at least for people who are young at the time of their offense. So, you know, states like Connecticut and Nevada and California, it's really a diverse group of states, West Virginia, that are starting to at least put more procedural protections in so that young people are going to get an in-person hearing, that they can get an evaluation, that they might have lawyers. I mean, I think in general, we're going to see a lot of states, including New York, really pay more more attention to parole, because finally states are recognizing that the reason they have overburdened prison populations is because people are spending longer in prison than ever before, not just because they get longer sentences, but because they're vanishing opportunities of release. Parole is failing them, other early release mechanisms are failing them, and we have a very not only bloated prison system, but an incredibly expensive one as people get older and sicker and are dying in prison.
And we know that Governor Cuomo has ordered an investigation into racial bias in New York State prisons in response to the New York Times investigation. You mentioned in your report, Sarah, South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And I think in South Dakota, the burden is on the parole board to provide evidence for why the person needs to remain in prison, as opposed to the prisoner saying, like, why it should be let out. Is that a model that you support?
Exactly. I mean, one of our chief recommendations in the report is to have more of what they call a presumptive parole system, where, you know, once you get to your first date of eligibility that is generally set by the courts, there is a presumption that this person should be released unless the person is still a risk or they haven't been sufficiently rehabilitated. And then I think not only does that really focus, again, on what is forward-looking, how this person is doing now instead of who they were at the time of the crime, but it also should provide more political support for our parole board members to make the right decision, to look at how the person's doing, to have hearings that are only looking at what the person needs to do if they're going to be denied going forward. It's a much more efficient system as well, but it's also one that is much more fair and more true to the real principles of parole.
And Issa, any more policy recommendations, possibly maybe letting the prisoners know what the board is looking for so that they can kind of work toward that?
Right. I mean, well, unfortunately, Sarah, right now the board is essentially just looking for people to spend more time in prison. And so we need changes at the legislative level. So we're calling on New York State legislators to introduce some sort of change to the executive law along the lines of what Sarah just recommended. They introduced this summer possible new regulations that were thoroughly inadequate, that put youth as simply one of many considerations that the board could weigh. And we know what happens there. They just always find that the crime of conviction outweighs every other consideration. So we're calling on the state to actually change the law. And we hope that courts actually hold parole boards to the law that already exists.
All right. And I think we're going to end it there for time. Unfortunately, we can't get to any more calls. But thank you, everyone, for calling in and for sharing your guys' stories. Sarah Mehta is a researcher at the American Civil Liberties Union, and she is the author of the new report, False Hope, How Parole Systems Fail Youth Serving Extreme Sentences. And Issa Kohler-Hausman is an associate professor of law and sociology at Yale University, who has represented clients seeking parole. Sarah and Issa, really thank you both for coming in.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And you're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Sarah Gonzalez filling in for Brian. Next up, what does Donald Trump's election victory mean for President Obama's legacy? Stay with us.